this week, precious metals indices mostly higher while U.S. stocks soared with the Dow Jones up nearly 700 for the week. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's a pleasure to be back with you for this June 8th show with another two Muy Grande-sized guest interviews in the Season 13, Episode 650 edition. Chris Martinson kicks off the show from peakprosperity.com, author of Prosper. He says the global macroeconomic outlook is dire. Central bank QE operations tend to lead to consequences, in particular runaway inflation, which could bode well for precious metals investors. He suggests keeping an eye on real tangible wealth. What asset class better fulfills this role? Gold and related shares. We also discuss a couple of techniques that everyone can use to improve health, lower overall calorie consumption, and improve quality of life without spending a single dinero. Then global financier Martin Armstrong of Armstrong Economics rejoins us with his latest market commentary. He expects the precious metals bull market to reassert itself. The Armstrong economic model currently anticipates near parabolic U.S. equities. He agrees with me that the Dow could double yet again from current levels to as high as 40, even 50,000. And don't forget our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900. You'll want our mailbox number, 514049. Please jot it down or plug it right into your phone. You can call us at any time. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies persisted over the precious metals sector as the six-week dollar rally came to a screeching halt, turning investors back to safe haven investments. By Friday's close, gold was up $3, less than a quarter percent, finishing at 1302, still holding that important support level. Silver picked up 3 dimes, 3/10 of a percent, ending at 1674 an ounce, while the XAU precious metal shares gave back fractional amount, finishing just shy of 83. Black gold gave back also a fractional amount, ending at 65.74, while the Bitcoin ETF, GBTC, picked up 60 cents, 5%, ending at 12.10, holding that long-term support. And the Tezos pre-tokens futures remain near recent highs, blasted higher, just as expected in this report, up well over 100 to 150% since we first suggested the lows were in place, over $5 per token currently. The top story moving the precious metals sector. According to the Labor Department, U.S. jobless claims fell slightly this month, holding the number of layoffs close to a 50-year low. Initial weekly jobless claims dropped 1,000 to 222,000 for the week ended June 2nd. The number of Americans filing for unemployment benefits unexpectedly declined as well, indicating tighter labor conditions. The labor market payrolls are close to full employment levels. The national unemployment rate is also at an 18-year low of just 3.8%, holding firm. These solid inflation and lower jobless claims virtually ensure a rate hike next week at the FOMC meeting scheduled for Wednesday. We expect the overnight lending rate to jump a quarter percent to 2%. The CBOE Fed futures contracts indicate 91% odds of a rate hike at the June 12th through 13th policy meeting. Meanwhile, trade war issues continue to plague the markets, issues between the U.S. and its major trading partners, as the Group of Seven Nations will hold talks in Canada this weekend. Growing concerns put the greenback under pressure and strengthen support for the precious metals amid intensifying global trade disputes. The feud between Washington and Canada, Mexico, Europe, and China is clearly intensifying. The French President Emmanuel Macron proposed that the U.S. is wrecking global diplomatic relations, calling for the world's largest economy to be removed from the G7 group. Good luck with that, sir. Precious metals, bottom line. The U.S. dollar rally came to a halt on buy next week's FOMC rate hike and sell the fact. The technical outlook remains solid for precious metals, with the same pattern from 2009 suggesting a big breakout in gold and silver in the coming months, with a consolidation target of $21 silver and $1,500 gold as soon as this summer, running into the seasonably favorable end of the year. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange this week as investors accumulated discounted shares on better-than-expected economic numbers from the U.S. Labor Department. Plus, the three-week pullback in crude oil, albeit temporary, provided another positive boost for potential corporate profits and share prices. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones Industrials picked up nearly 700 points, about 3%, well above that 25,000 psychological level of 25,316. The S&P 500 added 44 points, 1.5% at 2779, while the NASDAQ Composite added 91, 1.2%, finishing at 7645. Shares in the news included DocuSign, D-O-C-U, up almost 3.5% after the tech company's earnings topped analyst expectations. Plus, one of our favorite alpha stocks, gold miners, Royal Gold, RGLD, was one of the best performing precious metal shares this week. And General Electric picked up 1% on news that the industrial conglomerate was holding its dividend steady. And Procter & Gamble picked up about 2%, while Coca-Cola KO added over 1%. U.S. shares, bottom line. Our favorite USA Today 7 indicator, greed to fear index, pendulum finally broke above the neutral category, registering a slightly greedy signal for the first time in over a month, suggesting that the herd is returning to the market and prices might be temporarily overextended. Nevertheless, I continue to anticipate new record equities prices in 2018. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Stay with us. Yesterday says the European Central Bank is at risk of failing, which could send interest rates soaring, outlines contingency plans for investors to shield their portfolios. Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, and founder of Princeton Economics. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You know, the Fed meeting minutes, they showed very little new guidance on policymakers' plans. The markets shrugged off the latest meeting minutes. Give us an idea of your take on the situation.
The real issue is that you kind of have to understand what's really behind it. Janet Yellen used to come out all the time and say, look, we have to normalize interest rates. The Fed's claimed, 2% target for inflation. It's been chronically undershot. And mainly because we're in this mode of people don't really trust the future. They aren't rushing out and borrowing money, and even, retail participation in the stock market still at about half the levels that it was in 2007. You have a lot of people that are still behind the eight ball in real estate. I actually have a friend who is a real estate guy, and his house up in New Jersey, he can't even afford to sell it because it's worth less than the mortgage. So he just rents it out. That's it. So, I mean, the Fed is basically saying we have to normalize interest rates, and it's the code word for really what, the chronic problem. Central banks lowered rates thinking that they would stimulate demand, and it just didn't work. And now what they've done is they've undermined all the pension funds. You have even, CalPERS in California talking about raising taxes because they're below funding levels. Illinois, that the state's basically bankrupt. All over the place. Europe is a complete disaster. Americans are always, very myopic. They only look at the United States. They're not paying attention to what's happening in Europe. Even the Great Depression. Sure, there was a minor correction in the stock market from 29 into 30. What really sent the stock market down dramatically to 10 cents on the dollar was the sovereign debt crisis. That hit in 1931. And how did it start? It started with the bank going over in Austria. The bank happened to be one of the owners was Rothschilds. So when the rumor hit that the Rothschilds were going bust, then they started selling bank shares. It turned into a contagion. You can go online and just read Herbert Hoover's memoirs. They're free. From 1931. And what he explains is that capital acted like a loose cannon on the deck of a ship in the middle of a hurricane. He said it was rushing from one, thing to the next, and they couldn't form a committee fast enough to figure out what was going on. Anybody in the industry, you can apply those words to 2010. As soon as Greece went down, what did the traders do? They looked around and said, made a lot of money on this one. Who's next? Oh, Portugal. Then they went after Portugal, then Spain and Italy, etc. This is the way contagions happen. Right now, I mean, the FDIC has just put Deutsche Bank on the watch list as a problem bank, and that's the biggest bank in Europe. We have a major banking crisis in Europe.
Didn't we see sort of a canary in the coal mine emerge last year with the Carillion disaster emanating from London, where this construction behemoth just imploded virtually overnight, taking down billions of dollars of investment money? And it emerges later that it was the best well-known disaster out there, that all the smart money had been shorting it for months.
I mean, Deutsche Bank's basically the same thing. I mean, there's been probably articles I've written about it that, I mean, they have a derivative portfolio of about $45 trillion. Now, you net it out, it's still worth three or four times the capitalization of the bank. You have to ask yourself, and this is the way the smart money looks at this. Everybody knows that there's a problem with Deutsche Bank, but it's too big. You would normally merge a bank that's in trouble. And that's how they operate. So the only other bank in Germany is Commerzbank, and that has the same kind of problem. This is why the euro doesn't work. The only bank you could possibly merge it with would be BNP, and that's French. Now you have the political problems of Europe. Oh, well, we can't let the French bail out the Germans. It's all political. The bail-ins, people misunderstand what bail-ins are. It's not basically because they don't want to bail out, you know, the bankers again. That's not really the issue. The issue is, in Europe, if the Italian banks go down, then the Germans and the Dutch go, well, gee, we want to put in our money to bail out the Italians. We all knew they had a problem. This is where the bail-in comes in. No, you're not going to get any money from the rest of us, so you're just going to have to take it in from all the investors there and anybody that has money in the bank. That's really what the bail-in's about. I mean, this is why the euro is failing. It was a single currency, but they never got past all the political ramifications in the history, you know, the bad taste in everybody's mouth from two world wars.
Let's move over to the precious metals for a minute. Every time the market looks like it's ready to break out of this two-year-long consolidation, roughly, the greenback seems to move against it, putting it under some pressure, especially with the likelihood of at least another rate hike in June and then maybe one more in December this year. It seems to have investors less concerned about safe haven investments against the backdrop of what we see in North Korea and, of course, in the Middle East. What are your thoughts on gold and silver?
We're still in this consolidation mode, and you're correct in the sense that, you know, you have the what they call the gold bugs, and they'll buy gold no matter what happens. But that's not enough to get people to actually want to run out and buy gold. The average person on the street has to get to that stage where they don't trust government, and we're not there yet. After 2020, you know, then the story will change, but we're still in this period of consolidation, and you have to understand, with the problems that we see outside the country, in Europe, I mean, Japan, the big money, there's only one place to go, and that's the dollar. I mean, we saw, you know, with the Italian elections and the crisis in the euro this past week, I've been warning people. I said, you know, your interest rates can go to 10% overnight. And they thought, oh, that's absolutely ridiculous. Well, in Italy, interest rates went from 0.3% to 2.5% in one day. You have to understand what this quantitative easing has done. The Fed has backed off. The Fed has also said whatever they bought, it will mature and they will not rebuy it. Okay, that's responsible. So the Fed is reducing its balance sheet. Everybody bashes the Fed all the time. Nobody looks outside this country. You had Bank of Japan stand up and brag. They thought it was good. They bought 97% of their own debt. In Europe, why did interest rates rise so fast in a single day in Italy? Because the only buyer is the ECB. Both of them have destroyed their local bond markets. I mean, a pension fund is not going to buy debt from Italy for 10 years at 1.3%. They need 8% to break even. Who's going to buy this stuff? It's all manipulated. The central banks of Japan and Europe have been the buyers. That's it. There is no other buyer. So this is why the dollar goes up. For big money, the only place they can come is the United States. There's no competition.
Move on to the U.S. equities markets. You've outlined correctly in recent interviews that you watch the international monetary flows, I should say money flows, from outside the United States certainly help keep price elevated in recent years. You're one of the ones to correctly call this. We've only had a handful of bulls, permabulls, remain on the show, and you've been right so far. Do you see any reason to change that outlook?
Our model's, you know, very specific, and how fast it would elect a buy signal is critical. Like from 1929, it elected a monthly sell signal the very first month. All right, in 1907, I think it took 3 months. We're not even remotely close to a monthly sell signal. We warned it, okay, fine, yes, we're going to have a high in the Dow in January. And in the first half of this year would be consolidation. This is because people are just trying to figure out where we're going. But then you had, the NASDAQ make new highs in March. And here you have the Russell 2000 going up, making new highs. Now, that's more of the mutual fund place to park money. So that index is different than the S&P, the NASDAQ, and the Dow. The Dow tends to reflect more of international capital. But with interest rates this low, honestly, the only shot is good equities. That's it. That there have been a number of government-run pension funds in various states. They ran off into emerging markets trying to get higher yield.
If you try to chase after debt, you're taking on an awful lot of interest rate sensitivity and exposure to higher rates, whereas if you turn to equities and you do catch that dart that happens to be the one that has the high alpha, you might really outperform other portfolios. Do you expect this trend to continue? Do you see, as maybe inflation starts to reemerge, that equities remain robust? Could we see a doubling in the Dow from here to, say, 40,000, 50,000?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what our model's been projecting. I know a lot of people are like, that sounds crazy. But, the amount of money in sovereign debt alone is over $200 trillion globally. You're not even talking about, a major shift when, as the smart money goes, I just can't take this anymore, and they just move to equities. This thing gets to explode. I mean, you can go to our site at Armstrong Economics. I posted charts on the P.E. ratio, all right, going back decades. The actual peak was 2009. Everybody goes, well, why would the P.E., peak almost 200% in 2009? Because at that point, what happens is smart money realizes what's the risk of going down any further at this point versus the government, and they're all in trouble. They just look at it and say, at this point, I'll just park my money. Do you really want to, buy government debt at that point when it's negative? So if they put money into the blue chip equities, which is what they did, if they break even, they're ahead of the game.
It's almost a self-reinforcing vortex because you have the upward momentum brings in companies to purchase up their shares, and then that leads to a lower float, higher prices. As we said earlier, there is nowhere else to make your capital productive. Let's maybe jump forward, though, to the end game. Do you expect to see something similar to 2000? .com blow-off, or might it be something like 2008, the Great Recession?
Historically, you can go back basically hundreds of years. And a lot of people heard, of Andrew Jackson fighting the Bank of the United States and shutting down the central bank back then. They cheered. Well, what happened was instead of a central bank where you parked your money, they parked it in all the state different banks. And then that just led to corruption. You can go on eBay and buy called the broken banknote. Or every bank issued its own paper money. Every single bank. And then they start going bust. So then the states tried to bail out their local banks, and then the states went bust. So the sovereign debt crisis of the 1840s was all the states going down. I mean, a number of the states just, defaulted on their debt permanently. So then the 20s, all right, we had the European governments default. We had Asia defaulted. Britain even went into a moratorium. Eventually they came out of it. So sometimes you have, it's like a Shakespeare's play. It can be played out for hundreds of years. It's always the same plot, but the actors change. Sometimes it's the sovereign debt as far as federal is concerned, and other times it's the private sector. Then other times it's the municipal level. All right, this time we have municipal and federal both in trouble. It's not the corporate side. So, you know, this is why the stock market is, you know, has been going up, and it's going to go up higher. You know, the problem isn't in the equity side. The problem is government.
You don't really charge anything at the website there, do you?
No, you don't even have to register. Expect people's privacy.
I mean, that's quite a public service you're providing. I mean, if you don't have a financial motive, is it an educational that drives your content?
Pretty much. I mean, honestly, look, I've done very well in my life. I don't really need to work anymore. But I've also dealt with governments for, you know, close to 40 years. And I just ended up in a very unusual position. What it was that I was called in back in 1985 when they were going to form the G5. There were 35 of us. And at first I thought, wow, I guess I made it, you know. And so then you realize, you know, gee, you know, okay, Mr. Armstrong, how do we save the world? Oh, very sorry, your 15 minutes is up next. Then they stand up and they say what they wanted to say all along. And then they pretend that they relied upon all these experts, of which they, what they're doing, nobody recommended.
That's the MO, isn't it? That's, I mean, you can see that even down to the PTA meeting. They already have the solution, and they just want you to feel like you've been part of a consensus that came to the solution, and it doesn't work out that way.
Yeah, I was literally told, because at that point, you can go on our site, you'll see. I wrote a letter to the White House, because I said, you know, this is a waste of time, basically. I got a two-page letter response, and only because I was part of this committee, so they had to really respond to me. They basically, and I warned them, I said, if you're going to lower the value of the dollar by 40% with this G5 stuff, I said, you know, you just sold a third of the national debt to basically Japan. Don't you think you're going to sell this stuff? And they just look at you and their eyes glass over it. They have no clue of the financial markets at all. I warned them, volatility is going to go up. Within 2 years, you're going to cause a crash. That was the 87 crash. So then when the 87 crash comes, then they're calling me, oh, gee. I said, I'm sorry. You know, I'm not interested. Then they start lobbying my friends so that I would go in. And then when I go into this Brady Commission thing, you know, it starts off with the same thing. They have some academic from some university, and he said, well, we're going to try and find the guy that forced this market down. And I said, excuse me. I said, every investigation since 1907 has begun the same way. You never found any mythical giant short. What makes the market go down? I said, you even understand how a market trades. Yeah, I borrow stock from one person and I sell it to the other. I said, okay, fine. So how does a short position ever outnumber the longs? It can't. I said, in futures, everything's matched. And he's just looking at me. And he says, well, I teach finance at one of the major universities. I said, that's very nice. On well over $1 trillion. I understand what goes on. And he says, well, what makes it go down? I said, you've never traded, have you? I said, everybody's long. It could be anything that comes out, and all of a sudden, they try to sell. And you get into these downdrafts, there's no bid. So all of a sudden, a Dow can drop 1,000 points in a single day. I said, it's no bid. Nobody's shorting it. And they try to sell, there's nobody there.
Then add to the mix, you have 70 to 90% of the NYSE volume now likely automated trading, robotic trading, some people refer to it, facing a scenario where even the robots are turned off and there's absolutely no bids across the board. We saw a flash crash, you know, something like that, I guess, is what you're also referring to.
Yeah, I mean, the robots will shut down, and the danger is something like that happens so rapidly.
Any further thoughts on the markets? I mean, my guess is you probably have a gut feel for what we should expect for the second half of 2018.
Pay more attention, basically, to Europe. The euro has come down dramatically. I mean, it's a currency that is absolutely doomed. You really, there's no hope of saving this thing. You know, you have a single currency, but you don't have a single continent. And everybody's, oh, we're not going to bail out them because that's the Italians or that's the French or this. Everybody's against everybody else still. And that's the problem. I mean, once you undermine that confidence, then everything starts to come unglued. That's when you see the stock market starting to rise dramatically. The Fed will raise interest rates because they need to raise them simply to try and save the pension funds. This is not even about inflation. This is about effectively just trying to get the monetary system and saving it.
If you were going to construct a mythical portfolio for, you know, just the typical American, is there anything that you'd add or try to keep out of that portfolio this time? Maybe a solid base of gold, silver, precious metals, XAU?
Just have to keep in mind that the big money institutions, they don't buy gold. They can't run down and buy $20 gold pieces and stuff like that. So gold is more of a retail market avenue. Institutions can go into the equity side, gold stocks, things of that nature. But the one thing you definitely don't want to have is any form of government bonds whatsoever. Municipals, federal, get out of any of that sort of stuff. If you want any kind of fixed income, just go to AAA companies and keep it short term. Don't go buy any of these 100-year bonds that they're selling. I mean, that's great. I would look at that because keep in mind that, for example, the last time Italy got in trouble, what did they do? You may have had 30-day paper. They couldn't pay, so they stood up and said, oh, we're not defaulting. We're just converting all 30-day paper into 10-year notes. You know, government can do whatever it wants. A private sector can't do that. IBM couldn't do it, or Apple, or whatever. But governments can do whatever they want, and they are the ones who prosecute people, so they never prosecute themselves. There are no mirrors in Washington.
Tell people a little bit more about the fantastic services you provide online and totally for free, which is a real public service here.
I have the actual experience with governments. You have to understand that they will always act out of their self-interest, period. I mean, I actually had the mandate from Hong Kong to buy land from Australia so that they could have moved. I met with the prime minister several times. And I even said to them, I have a blank check here, selling this island off the coast of Australia, and I'll pay off your national debt. They said no. And I finally got him to say, what is the problem? Why can't we come to some sort of a deal here? And he said, no, they're not labor people. They were afraid that if they allowed the people from Hong Kong to come in, what would happen? They would change the vote, and then the labor government would be out, and they would be in there with conservatives. So it has nothing to do with economics or anything. It's who's going to win at the end of the day.
Speaking of winning, your Forecaster film did quite well, and I'd be remiss if I didn't inquire into any further projects. I know you've had some on the drawing board for a while.
Yeah, no, they are doing a Hollywood movie. They're turning it into a Hollywood movie. They want to do another one of the Forecaster, but concerning Europe and everything else and dealing with it from that perspective. So, but it's just an example of how corrupt the system has become. And it's just really ridiculous. When that film debuted in Amsterdam, the third night we had all the bankers from, all over Europe. And the moderator wanted to pretend he was, unbiased. But he says, oh, so did you ever, whatever happened to the $1 billion? You got to keep it? What? And I said, why don't we just ask the audience? I said, is it possible for $1 billion to be missing from a bank and nobody knows where it is? The whole audience starts laughing. I said, you either write a check, you wire it out, or you beam it out like Star Trek. All right, well, take care. Thank you for inviting me.
Glad you're back with us here at Gold Seek Radio. It's a pleasure to welcome back co-founder of PeakProsperity.com, author of the best-selling book, Prosper, Chris Martin. So how are you, Chris?
Oh, I'm doing very well today, Chris.
You know, we had a chat pre-show, a lot going on from the crypto space to the markets in general. Just to give you the floor and tell us what you're watching most closely right now.
You know, here we are almost 10 years now into this expansive monetary printing time, and What we're looking at, of course, is eventually everybody knows the party has to end. And in times past, the central banks would have to take the punch bowl away, and they used to do it, you know, very early and regularly. But under Greenspan in the 90s, he decided that you could do away with this pesky thing called the business cycle and replace it with the credit cycle. So that's what he did, 94, 95, opened up the sweeps programs, banks could lend on, you know, unregulated ways, and we blew up in 1998 with long-term capital management. They rescued that, put the Greenspan put under the market, boom, 2000 blew up. Bernanke comes in, and we had the housing bubble, that blew up, but that was another credit cycle, and here we are at the peak of probably the largest credit cycle in all of human history. And of course, it isn't just the U.S. Fed we have to talk about, but the European Central Bank been doing the real heavy lifting in this story, plus Bank of Japan, on and on. So my view is that, you know, you watch where the cracks are going to appear. They always appear, Chris, from the outside in. So where do you look? Well, you look in the junk debt, that's the triple C rated, or, you know, BB minus or whatever. You're looking at the weaker countries. You know, you want to watch Greece before you watch Italy, before you watch Spain, before you watch, you know, Germany, and so on. And so as we look across that landscape, macroeconomically, what I'm seeing right now, the thing that concerns me the most is something called the credit impulse, which is looking at the year-over-year change in the amount of credit emitted into the markets. Now, why is that important? Because we are now in a not a business cycle, but a credit cycle dominated market. But that's what's been gifted to us over the last 30 years by the central banks. So, hey, watch the credit, not the business. The credit cycle has been in the negative impulse territory for about 6 months now. Usually takes about 6 to 12 months before that starts showing up. Everything looks pretty good right now, you know, in the United States, maybe not across the world, but, you know, it's okay. You know, unemployment's kind of low, and jobs, you know, seem relatively plentiful, and inflation's kind of where the, you know, Federal Reserve wants it, all that. But when you look at where we are in the credit cycle, we are now in the negative part of that cycle. Very hard to undo that without more quantitative easing by the banks. I can't see them doing that, Chris. I can't see it politically for a variety of reasons, all that. But so that's where I think we are. I think this is kind of late in the game. You know, you can participate, follow the leaders, you know, buy the fangs, do all that stuff, but very nimble, be very cautious.
So if I understand you correctly, to keep the music playing here, they'd obviously need another round or two or three or infinity of some type of QE. Rates have been held low or virtually zero. So clearly that means that U.S. equities at some point might actually have, I don't know, a 10 or 20% correction.
Listen, when business cycles came and went, you know, they were painful and people didn't like them. And so, of course, over a couple of iterations of that, the central bank said, great, if we could do away with the business cycle, because what happens in the business cycle is, you know, conditions tend to, you know, increase, and more people, businesses want to borrow more money, and then they borrow more money, and then interest rates start to begin to rise, and then they rise to a level that people can't afford, and then they, you know, next thing you know, you start to find out who was swimming naked. As Warren Buffett said, you know, you're finding out who made, you know, bad business decisions and who made bad loans to those businesses. And then, of course, you know, you Joseph Schumpeter, you creatively destroy that stuff out of the way. And then you start over again. So when you replace that, though, with something called the credit cycle, what you're really doing is you're saying we don't want the avalanche to come down into the valley. We don't like this cornice is being built up. So what we're going to do is we're going to put props under it. We're going to hold this thing up so it doesn't ever give way. But when it does give way, because it always will, it's far more destructive than if you had just that first little avalanche come through and sweep everything out. So that's the world we're in, and this is something we should have listened. Humans don't seem to be that terribly smart in collective. I think individually, I know tons of smart people, but groups of people, I don't know. So here's the thing. We had a credit cycle that blew up in 2000 through 2001. It was very painful. You know, we had your pets.com and world comms and Enrons and all that stuff, right? And then we replaced it with another credit cycle. We had this housing bust, and of course we had our Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and AIGs and all that stuff. That was very painful. Greece. And then that got replaced with another credit cycle. This is ultimately, forget all that monetary policy credit cycle versus business cycle. You and your listeners know what matters. Real value is what matters. And central banks don't print value. They don't create value. They don't create wealth. All they can do is print markers for wealth.
I know that you've mentioned precious metals in the past. That, of course, is our forte here, about gold, silver, and related shares.
The first thing I would advise everybody is you have to trust your own eyes in this story. So, look, to mine an ounce of silver. Come with me. Come. Somebody who's skeptical, come with me. We'll go to a mine, and I'll show you what's involved. It takes a ton of energy and diligence, and it's getting harder and harder to get that ounce of silver out of the ground. Same thing for gold. There was even an article, I think, this morning, or maybe it was yesterday, in the Wall Street Journal, which was that value investors, the people who understand fundamentals and look at value, they've just been having the worst possible time for a long time. This is what happens during speculative manias that are brought forward by money printing. So trust your own eyes, trust your own instincts. And so for me, you say, you know, this is tricky investing environment. No argument for me. Worst investing environment ever. So what do? Well, you have to understand what real value is. Understand that value is something that's tangible. It's something you can touch. You can eat it. You can drink it. You can use it. You can barter with it. And that's real value. You got to be sure that most of your actual wealth, what you're calling wealth, is encased within real, tangible wealth. And I'm sure your listeners are familiar with that. You know, beyond that, hey, nobody knows how the future is going to go. Listen, maybe it's going to become more digitalized, and maybe it'll become more fantasized. Maybe it'll be, you know, who knows which country's going to win. We don't know any of that. But history says we have to be careful at times like this, because what's really happened is the central banks have printed trillions of claims against wealth that has not yet been created. And that's always been a very dangerous situation.
You alluded to earlier just how this is one of the, I'll paraphrase, least intelligent social experiments collectively as a society. But I mean, sure, it's different this time, but it rhymes. And we've certainly seen many, many fiat money experiments that never quite ran to these extremes. So let's talk about some of the ideas of hedging. Let's talk about the concept of, you know, insurance for the everyday investor. What do you see ahead for the yellow metal and silver?
I like the precious metals, of course. Gold and silver are two words to me, not one. And gold is a hedge against the monetary insanity I see. And I'm absolutely convinced that we're going to get into that. Austrian von Mises described it very well, that the only way out of a credit expansion is either you voluntarily abandon it or you face a catastrophe of the currency system involved. Now, unfortunately, in this particular story, what's different this time is the currency system involved is the world's currency system. That involves euros, yen, dollars, rubles, you know, yuan, everything. So everybody's kind of tied up in this one, which is going to make it go on for longer than you would expect. Silver is a different metal to me. I don't tie that to the monetary system. I don't know any country that's sort of using it as a reserve asset in their central banking system. But, oh my gosh, I love silver. It's the most shiny, reflective, conductive, wonderful substance ever, and I believe that there's going to be an industrial economy in the future. So I love silver. Now, I actually love a bunch of the metals that are existing out there right now at this point in time. I like nickel a lot because of the electric story. I've been in very much a proponent of that for quite a while. I like indium. There's a whole bunch. A large story that I tell at Peak Prosperity is if you really look and you go and you investigate the mining industry, you discover that, forget what the central banks are doing, they're printing stuff, they're making fantasy numbers and tape digits show up on, you know, CNN at the end of the day. What matters is things are getting deeper, more dilute, and more distant. 3Ds, they're just getting harder and harder to find and get out of the ground. Not impossible, but just more expensive, you know, when you put those 3Ds together. So there's a lot of items out there that the world needs. And by the way, we just ticked over 7.6 billion, you know, a few weeks ago. We'll be at 8 billion before you know it. People, and by the way, these aren't just all, you know, people sort of hunkering down in Bangladesh. The number of middle-class people are rising in China, in India, all over the world. They all want the same lifestyle that you and I have available to us in the United States or Europe. And this is going to create extraordinary demand for resources. These resources cannot be printed up. So go ahead, Federal Reserve, go ahead, you know, residential banks, print to your heart's content. But if you don't understand where we are in the resource story, and by the way, they don't. I've been to meetings with Federal Reserve officials. They literally don't. They're like, well, we can just assume if we need more nickel, there will be more. I'm like, no, these are the mines. Here they are. There's only so many. Where's the next one? You know, they're like asteroids. They have this fantasy set. So for people who can see this story for where it is and see with their own eyes, that's extraordinary opportunity in this story.
Firstly, you have that inelastic supply and demand, or close to inelastic supply, but awfully inelastic demand. And when you bring those two together, in particular with silver, ignore the fact that we might have a lull in industrial demand due to another great recession. If you ignore that and you just focus on your first point, 7.6 billion folks, every now and then people lose their cell phones, they break, they toss them out, their keyboards, their computers, their laptops, LCD TVs and whatnot, filled with micro amounts of silver. And it's very difficult to extract. It's not energy efficient. Because it's so cheap, you know, silver might reassert itself, I'm leading up to here, as the people's gold, again, for some of those who just couldn't even afford a single ounce of gold. Silver, I think, is an, you know, competing asset.
Chris, I love silver in this story because it's below the cost of production right now. And I love oil for the same reason right now. I love a variety of things. So when there's a commodity that humans need that's below the cost of production, you're guaranteed the price has to rise at some point in time. Silver at $16.40 an ounce, roughly rounding where it is today when we're recording this, its value is way beyond that. But I can point to a variety of resources with that. That is the story of the next 10 years. This is going to be the most amazing story of where people wake up and go, oh my, it's not how many eyeballs pets.com have in the 2000s, and they're not going to say how many alleged users does Facebook have, which I think is probably overinflated by 50%. They're going to say, oh, wait, what grows crops and what builds things and what, to your point, right now, people, yeah, cell phones, a little flip phone, just throw it away because the silver in there is not worth harvesting at $16.45, so we're losing it. If silver was $165 an ounce, people would say, oh, this cell phone's actually worth $10 on the, you know, like a lead acid battery. They'd be like, oh, yeah, we could turn this in and get money for it. We're losing critical assets because they've been mispriced by the most deformed money system and pricing structure that has ever existed in the world.
So let's talk about some practical strategies for the everyday listener, how they can benefit with what we both agree are very discounted prices on some of these safe haven assets.
I'd love to. Thank you for that. And of course, it always matters, what are we going to do with this information? Listen, information without action is useless, maybe just troubling. We've been talking about what we would call financial capital. So, you know, should I put my money into silver or gold or maybe oil, or obviously financial assets, you know, should you put your money in gold or silver or, you know, into, you know, any asset you could put it into. But one of the things that we really focus on at Peak Prosperity is that there are actually 8 forms of capital that we've identified, but there could be 20. And those other forms of capital besides financial might be your living capital, which you and I have talked about in the past, which is your own health, your own body, the food you're putting in, the things you're choosing not to put in there, having a garden, things like that, your social capital, all of this and that. So for younger people listening to you, to us at this point in time, you know, they may not have a lot of financial capital, and honestly, some of them don't have any opportunities to accumulate a lot, given, I don't know, you know, the way the deck is stacked against them, or, you know, the student loans they might have, or just the way the system is structured. So the thing that I care about the most is that people are building themselves towards resilience, because my view, and I could be wrong, but I'm not confused, is that the world is changing extremely rapidly, in some ways for the better, in some ways rapidly for the worse. We tend to, as a species, focus on the more positive things and kind of ignore the more negative things. So we're going to do more amazing things with technology in order to more efficiently, hey, you know, who knows, maybe we don't need cars anymore. We're going to have driverless cars, all that. That's true. And, you know, the right whales didn't breed this year at all in the Atlantic, and there's fewer insects than ever before, and we're losing, you know, weather patterns. So what do you do with all that? My view is you have to be as resilient as possible, because there are going to be changes coming.
I do like to end our discussions with some pragmatic opportunities, real world things that can help our listeners. And I don't know if you've ever seen the Joe Rogan show, but he's kind of a smash hit online, of course, for adults only. Some of the doctors that he has are rather remarkable. And one of them, I believe her name is Dr. Rhonda, this nutritionist, she pointed out that, because we've learned today, right, that calorie restriction is the hallmark of a long life. In general, calorie restriction, which means eating less, one thing that everybody pretty much can start doing today, most of us rarely go 12 to 14 hours without consuming something other than water. Most of it occurs while you're sleeping. You know, somewhere around 10 hours in the bedroom people spend, right? You don't have a soda. You can't have anything but water. And we're not talking about using any chemicals. We're not talking about an $8,000 Stairmaster. We're not talking about another membership. We're not talking about preparing for a hike of Mount Everest. Just calorie restriction. I'd like your thoughts.
The one, by the way, that I believe in the most is the 16-8 version, which, and here's how you decode that. Let's imagine that your last meal, the last calorie, the last, besides water, you know, whatever, you brush your teeth, I don't know if there's any calories involved, but the last thing you ingest, with which has calories in, is 8 o'clock at night. Your first meal would be at 12 o'clock the next day. That gives you 16 hours off of calories and 8 hours on. And so when you do that, you're eating from 12 to 8. And if you do that, it's amazing. The data's clear. There's tons of studies. Anybody listening, look at intermittent fasting. You know, I wouldn't direct you to any one of them, but tons. And they all say that your metabolism is boosted by 10 to 14% if you get into that regime. And that's all you have to do. Burning 10% more calories, and then you combine that with starting to eat well, as you and I have talked about, where probably the best nutritionist, you know, person who sort of influenced me has said, you know, take your plate, it's a big round object, divide it in half. Half of that plate, 50%, has just the darkest green vegetables you can put on there. I don't know, kale and collards or whatever, broccoli, all that stuff. The next quarter of your plate, so we're up to three quarters now, the next quarter has got some kind of really high-quality fat on it. And then the next quarter, you're putting really high-quality roughage on there. I mean, you want the most amazing stuff, right? So that's kind of how we're just designed to eat. And these have amazing results in my family.
It seems to promote sound rest. One of the key interfaces with the external world is our digestive system. You'd give that 12 to, as you say, 16, she suggests 14 hours. They didn't see any statistical benefit past 14. When you look at it all together, intermittent fasting combined with hourly exercise, the AMA has done just a tremendous amount of research, I'm sure you've seen this, indicating that it's really less the strenuous nature of our exercise. You know, oh, I'm going to run 15K this weekend or every weekend. But it really comes down more to the fact that we're too sedentary, always in front of a computer screen, whoever we are, wherever we are. This study suggested just simply standing up and walking briskly for at least about 2 minutes every hour on the hour. And I've stuck religiously with it, believe it or not, for 3.5 years from a cardiovascular level. The tendency is to let 2, 3, 4 hours fly by before you realize it because you get caught on some assignment or you're stuck at the desk or whatever it is. And you just have a timer. You know, and it forces you to get up. And the other thing I found is that it really helps regulate the lymphatic system, which you know is the sewer system of the body. It just flows more efficiently when we are walking. This is proven. Any closing thoughts you want to bring together on health?
Totally agree with nearly everything you've said, and I'm going to take some of what you said to heart, because really just the most important thing is to remain active, eat well, and that's it. So everything I've been studying, you know, I've been through, like, you know, this amazing biochemistry and all this stuff, and people like, oh, gut biome, all this stuff. But the truth is, if you just eat right, you've solved 80% of it. And if you can continue to move and move in new ways, you've got probably 18% of the remaining, you know, 20%.
Always a pleasure. Please return to the show.
Well, I'd love to. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. We'll be right back.